Hello, everyone, and welcome to Primecast episode 27. Here's what's been going on at Privateer Press over the past month. We've added lots of new rules to the War Machine app over the past few weeks, including the Necrofactorium Command Starter contents, Captain Yana Kavosky, the Firetongue Warrior Cadre from the Southern Creels, and rules for the Soul Carrion and Ancient Monolith terrain features, as well the exciting conclusion of the epic Emergence series, written by Eric Ryerson, published this past week. Whoa, what a bloodbath. Also, in App News, we're currently testing the print-to-PDF feature behind the scenes, and it's shaping up nicely. We should have an official update on that very exciting feature soon. Meanwhile, the Chimera Shard Incarnates and Dusk Ghosts of Ios are on their way to distributors and retailers with a release date set for May 14th. You can also pre-order them now in the Privateer Press online store and have them ship out on May 13th. Also available for pre-order with a ship date of May 17th is the Mastodon Colossal for the Kador Winter Core. Order before May 17th and we'll include a free hobby magnet pack for all your customizable parts on that big boy. Make sure to watch out for all the exciting previews we're posting almost daily on Facebook and Instagram. We've had the Necrofactorium and Gravedigger spoilers galore and more coming all the time. Speaking of the Necrofactorium, let's get on with the show and learn all about the darkest side of the Iron Kingdoms. This episode, I am joined by two very special privateers, Jason Soles and Matt Goetz, to talk about Crix Fiction. And this is a special one. Jason came out of nowhere and was just overjoyed to talk about this subject. Hit us up, and here we are. Jason, Matt.
Hey. I do want to point out how out of character Jason volunteering to be recorded is. Like, I think it's happened one other time in living memory.
I'm pretty sure my response was just, hell yeah.
If
Matt and Jason are going to be on the mic, you know it's going to be a good episode. And one that Jason volunteers for, you're in for a treat.
Kind of funny, too, because Jason and I, like, when we agree on stuff, we really agree on stuff. And when we disagree on stuff, it becomes violent. Ooh. So, fortunately, we agree.
Fantastic.
Waiting to see here where we don't agree.
Oh, yeah, man.
I wouldn't mind recording that, too. I'm sure it would be absolutely hilarious.
I don't know if hilarity is what I would call it, but there have been some strong debates in the past.
Awesome. Well, this one isn't up for debate. So, Jason, why don't you take us in?
In the process of writing the new fiction for the Necrofactorium for the compendium that's going into the War Machine app, I got to look back over all the history of Western Imran. I mean, pretty well since the beginning, and re-highlighting my memory, Crix's fingerprints all over everything.
Oh yeah,
and their machinations from the shadows. Kind of occurred to me that we could sit down and discuss the shadow history of Crix and how they've kind of evolved quietly as the Iron Kingdom grew and developed. And I mean, Crix is responsible for the final defeat of the Orgoth, ultimately at Garlghast. They're equally responsible for the Orgoth acquiring new warjacks by, well, shackling their war witches and knowledgeable classes into, you know, necromantic slavery, and then forcing them to become necrotechs and the first war witch adepts in Crix. And then as these captive Orgoth die or find a way to free themselves from the necromantic chains that Crix put on them, you have them returning to the outer abyss, where eventually both the Felgoth Infernals and the Goth themselves want them back, right? These people have intimate knowledge of Crix's machineries and the technologies behind fabricating warjacks, although obviously Orgoth take another tact with it. And instead of coal or necrotite, they're burning blaze, etc.
Mm-hmm. So, Jason, there's something really interesting in that kind of cross-pollination of technologies and occultism that mm-hmm. we see in an upcoming piece of fiction about Necrofactorium where one of the warcasters like directly observes the similarities between the Crixian warjacks that she has with her and the Orgoth warjacks of her counterpart. I liked that we get to see that from a character's perspective, as well as in the overview of these armies, that there is that intersection of technology and of science between them.
Are we getting that's Nikane's perspective there, right?
Yeah.
And she's uniquely well-placed also being an Iosian warcaster. So she's seen the Myrmidons as well. She's at an interesting crossroads, cross-section there.
So one thing that I really like in the write-up that you have done for the Necrofactorium, Jason, is you specifically articulate something that I've tried to explain to people at conventions and on podcasts and stuff, where when you're talking about Crix, you can't take the microcosm view. You have to take the macrocosm view, because they work on vastly different timelines to anybody else in the setting. And they're, no matter what it may look like they're doing, they have such a singular focus of purpose that nobody else in the setting has, where every single Lich Lord and Iron Lich and their underlings, the pirates, the Blighted Trollkin, all of them, ultimately, they serve as instruments of the Dragon Father's will. And his will is to collect his wayward children and devour them, right?
Yeah.
Like, you could be looking at the Shard invasions. You could be looking at Asphyxius's Necrofactorium in the Thornwood. You could be looking at this new Necrofactorium that's being set up. But all of that ultimately just falls down to Toruk and his goals on Imran. And I kind of love that there's this driving force and purpose behind everything they do that you have to be able to trace lines back to. No matter what actions they're taking in the immediate term, you're always thinking about that 10,000 year view.
I love how that plays with the fact that Toruk, being an ancient dragon with all the time in the world to figure everything out and all the patience to make it happen, but also it gives that undead Crixian view that, like, we don't have to win today, we don't have to win tomorrow. Our plans might take hold 100 years from now, as long as we have everything set up along the way.
For millennia. That's the other thing also, though, in that that different understanding of time, there's also a different understanding of victory. And the greatest losses, seemingly the greatest losses inflicted on Crix, might not do anything. I mean, Crix has lost armies over and over again. The Shard invasions and the that battle against the Orgothic Arlost, those were, you know, technically at least Pyrrhic defeats, if not total defeats for Crix. I mean, even if they did destroy the Orgoth kind of destroyed themselves, but they took with them three Lich Lords and basically every last thrall in Crix. Kind of ditto the Shard invasions. They were a time when Crix just burned through their reserves.
Also, the Shard invasions represent something kind of atypical, where we have the counterattack from Signar, where Venture led forces back into the Shard Islands.
And even then, though, I feel like they were learning as much about their enemies as they were repelling them, right? Like, Crix can take any military action and, you know, find the silver lining to it.
When you've got necromantic abilities to interrogate the dead about their technological developments, right?
And industrial scale thrall reanimation, you know, on the doorstep of the Iron Kingdoms.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Amazing. It reminds me of Scavrus interrogating skulls.
Yeah.
That's something funny. Like, the first time that we get to see this is on the mercenary Golden Lord, but the Grey Lords were so paranoid about that they actually, like, inlaid silver runes into their skulls to, like, make it more difficult for that forensic necromancy to take place.
They should have shared that tech with Signar. Right. Too late now, but Iron Kings would be in a different place.
Very, very. So one thing that I really like, too, is within the living, for instance, there's, like, this ambition is rewarded pretty consistently in Crix. So you'll see people that, you know, take take shots at higher powers than them, and they don't get punished for doing so. They get rewarded. Iacos is a great example of that.
Mm-hmm.
He took over Blackwater, a pretty significant city in Krix, after he took out Craythan Morvain, the former pirate king of Blackwater.
Mm.
And you see that all over the faction, that scheming to get yourself into a position of greater influence and authority is really characteristic of some of the Krixian characters.
Definitely. We get to see the same arc with Asphyxius and Denegra as well.
I think,
as long as you don't fail, they look pretty well upon your rise to power.
Yeah, and speaking of rises to power, like, Denegra is certainly, she's kind of mastered the game in Krix right now.
Mm. I'm curious, can you expand on that anymore?
She's kind of worked herself in the position of being Torok's underboss, or kind
the
of
the first among equals.
She's risen above the actual Council of Lich Lords and kind of wormed her way into being Torok's direct voice as he has been convalescing, you know, up until recent events.
And there's no small amount of resentment from some of the other Lich Lords about that. Like, Lich Lord Divinitas, the head of the Church of Torok, is mm-hmm. not happy about this situation.
I thought I was your favorite.
That's due to supply souls directly to, you know, the Dragonfather.
Yeah.
They gotta be on first name basis.
Awesome. So how does this tie into the greater story? We know that they've been a driving force, really the kind of main villain in a lot of different ways, and the punching bag to a lot of stories where the heroes get to rise and triumph. But like you said, those are all, you know, losses that Krix can take and grow from and expand. And now we're moving into a new era with a new invasion and new perils to the realms. Where does Krix fit into that?
Okay, so I'm going to roll us back to the Infernal War just for a quick second and say, during the Infernal War, Krix did something else that was unprecedented. They supported the living against the Infernals. They declared a side, knowing that if the Infernals won, there wouldn't be too many souls left to fuel their industries or, you know, bodies to reanimate, etc. And the power would shift dramatically to the side of the Infernals, obviously.
Mm-hmm.
And Krix expended its resources pretty dramatically. And among them, we saw the loss of Lich Lord Asphyxius. Mm-hmm. We saw the final ends to their Necrofactoriums on the mainland. We saw Krix take hits that Krix kind of uncharacteristically wasn't just going to get back. Like, there was no good road to recovery, especially with Torok suffering languishing from his wounds from the ongoing Dragon War. Krix was out of the fight, and its change of fortunes are real recent, and the Iron Kingdoms certainly haven't assessed them yet. They're going to hit them as a 1-2 punch, right? The Orgoth are here.
Ooh.
So the shortest terms, we have Krix emerging from nowhere, about to land on the mainland. We have the Orgoth reaching almost toward the pinnacle of their, you know, truly nefarious plans, which is what they have in store for the gods of Western Imran, which mm-hmm. I feel like we need to tell that story somewhere else. But also, the Dragon War itself has become destabilized. Blightergast has been consumed down and out.
I'm so glad that you mentioned that, Jason, because with Blightergast out of the equation, that tips the scales, right?
Mm-hmm.
That has weighted everything in Torok's favor at this point.
Mm.
We only really know what the dragons of Imran are like, but what we don't know is what the dragons of the rest of Kane are like.
Oh,
but it's quite likely the dragons of Imran are, they're in trouble. And Krix is closer to reaching its final ends than it ever has been in its history.
Within the fiction, right, Torok is the Dragon Father. He creates these dragons. Are you saying that there are other dragons like Torok that are that god-level dragon?
No, I'm saying that Torok's progeny exists exist
globally.
across canon. Yeah, they're global. They're just what we've seen on
Gotcha.
So,
yeah.
I have a personal theory that there are no dragons on Drak Orgoroth, just because of how the Orgoth acted when they first encountered and destroyed a dragon. They certainly didn't seem to have a lot of working knowledge of them at that point.
Knowing those guys, they would have tried to enslave it anyways. They're like, oh, that's big. We could probably put a collar on it.
If memory serves, I think they destroyed its body and threw its Aathank into a volcano, which allowed it to regrow its body very rapidly. So I'm suspicious that there might not be a ton of dragons around their homeland.
Mm. You can kind of figure between the lines there that the Felgoth Infernals also don't have a lot of familiarity with dragons up to that
Absolutely.
Point.
Absolutely, yeah.
No dragon souls to learn from?
I mean, what is a dragon soul?
It's the Aathank, right?
Well,
but when you... Sorry.
Well, I was just going to say, the Aathank is their essence. It is their being. It is the actual entity of the dragon. The body is just kind of a meat suit around that concentrated chaotic energy. But is that a soul?
I don't. That's a question you're supposed to answer. You can't ask me that.
It's a question we might someday answer.
Yeah, but it's not one that we have ever articulated or could easily explain right now, right?
Or possibly agree on.
Yeah, that's something that we could go back and forth on for a while.
Or maybe we do. Who knows?
That'll be the one we record the disagreement on, and I'm sure it'll be hilarious.
There'll be a lot of table banging, I'm sure.
Those are some fine points there.
Yeah. But those are the kinds of questions that always arise out of these deeper introspections into the setting and the lore, right? Like, when you look at how the Orgoth responded to their dragon, you can infer from that that they and their infernal allies don't really know what's up with that. You can ask the question, is the Aathank a soul? Does it qualify? Would it be able to empower a soul cage? Or could a necromancer use it to empower magic, right? Like, weird questions that you got to ask yourself about the setting.
Now, here's a necro question, and one I have always wondered, because we do know, like you said, that these Aathanks create meat puppets. Could one be reanimated?
The meat puppet?
Yeah, the dragon skin, the dragon body.
Oh, that's a good question. I mean, we know that their remains stick around at least for a little while after the Aathank is removed, because Pyromalefic's bones were harvested after he was destroyed to create the archangels and such. But I remember a conversation that we were having that without the Aathank's presence, the body is kind of inherently unstable.
Oh.
So you might be able to reanimate a dragon's corpse as a thrall, but by the time you finished inscribing all the thrall runes on his bones, they might not exist anymore.
Interesting.
It might also be so unnatural that the thrall runes have no effect.
Yeah.
Interesting.
Somebody could probably figure it out, I would guess, but it might not immediately work. And you'd think Mord would have tried something in there between the origins of necromancy and having Everblight sitting there with all of his spawn.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, and like Torok being kind of the dragon father and the necromantic center of Krix, like maybe he has the knowledge to reanimate dragon bones and is like, yeah, so we have a window and here are the runes. Make me a skeleton dragon.
I think Torok just wants to pick his teeth with dragon bones.
But what if he reanimated the skeleton to pick his teeth?
Like a plover bird?
Yes.
So related, unrelated, not to... subject. Something else interesting between Krix and the Felgoth Infernals is the role of the Deathjack in the evolution of Krixian Warjack technologies. There's a book in the fiction,
the Librum Mechanicus.
Librum Mechanicus, that details the construction of the Deathjack, and Krix had access to it. The Deathjack is a Well, we've softly said the product of Felgoth infernal magic. But
Interesting.
also, it becomes the template for Crix's first Helljax. Strongly influences the necrotechs for developing those technologies. Well, translating those technologies at the time into their, necro-industrial complex.
That is
so
sick.
That technological death spiral between Crix, the Orgoth, and the Infernals is even older than it seems initially.
Yeah.
Didn't Crix like originally find the Deathjack just wandering around?
I mean, they probably hunted it down.
Yeah.
They know a prize when they see it.
Nice.
Well, the thing that's really interesting to me about the Deathjack too is that it's not Crixian. You can take it in an army, right? But it operates on its own agenda, essentially. Mm-hmm. And somehow that agenda seems to line up with what Crix is doing in the world.
So maybe the Dragon Father has like some kind of knowledge of this, passes it on to the Lich Lords, and he's just like, follow the Deathjack.
Well, I mean, he certainly has been around and able to observe the happenings of stuff like that, right?
Hmm. That's really
the Lich Lords also probably have a lot of independent action. Go follow this guy. Go follow this, infernal, unique infernal warjack. That feels a little micromanagey for Torek.
Sure.
Yeah, totally.
But you've got Lich Lords like Thalassina, who is their like foreign affairs agent who has spies all over the place and is embedding people to feed information back. You also have Malathrax doing something very similar. So once those sightings of the Deathjack filter through all the Crixian double agents and secret spies and everything and feed back to Crix, I imagine doesn't take long for the Lich Lords to be like, hey, we should probably try and check this thing out.
Yeah, an artifact, a walking artifact with that much potential power and origins essentially unknown. Like, they can learn things from that.
Amazing. So, now that we have veered off into Deathjack land, where do we go from here?
You keep asking those questions, and I keep trying not to tell you. Aside from the release of the Necrofactorium army, which, let me tell you, as a long-time developer and explorer, there's some high-tier wish fulfillment there. Like, what do these zombies really do?
Actually, you have satisfied one personal desire of mine with the Necrofactorium army, a non-named Iron Lich. I've been wanting a generic Iron Lich model for so damn long, and finally we're going to get one.
You're kind of getting a couple.
Yeah, fair.
I mean, there's that solo waiting in the wings is their apotheosis caster, which I won't say a whole lot about right now.
Sure.
But just wait.
The Iron Lich Overseer might have been the first non-named Crix Iron Lich.
But the Overseer is tripartite, right?
Ooh,
it's
yeah.
Always got the three body problem going on. whereas this new one is like an update of the old classic Monsternomicon.
Yes.
Iron Lich, right? It just it looks so good, so crisp.
It does.
I cited that old illustration for that art.
Nice.
I kind of suspected you did because it looks so much like that classic Iron Lich silhouette.
Oh, I wanted to paint that thing forever.
I like how we also glazed over the apotheosis caster because I know and you guys know, but the audience doesn't know. And oh boy, is it good.
I feel like that's just needlessly cruel of you, Emmanuel.
Well, and they'll also, find out.
I'm going to leave a pin in that one until we, see what the concept art's like, because many a spill between a cup and lip.
Yeah.
Well, in other news, you have the Necrofactorium Compendium coming out soon, correct?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So we're going to get to see, up close and personal look at the Necrofactorium and what's going on with them. Is there anything you want to say regarding that fiction piece before it drops?
There's something that I'm thinking of, but Jason, do you want to go first?
I'll let you go first.
Okay. So one thing that I really like in the Necrofactorium Compendium is how we're seeing the entrenching of this military industry in Crix and really winding it up into a new kind of total war state almost, where you've got figures like Lich Lord Mortenebra, who is overseeing like mass scale production. I'm just picturing like factory lines of Thrall and Helljack and Bonejack construction, but because it's Crix and because it's Necrotex, like each one of them is his own little Da Vinci, having like flashes of mad genius and taking something off of a Helljack that was put on earlier in the production and replacing it with something else and cackling madly as they do so, right?
Amazing.
Writing that, I mean, you just think about what the Necrofactoriums must smell like and the charnel ships, etc.
Oh yeah, like any ship that has blood gorgers on it has to smell absolutely vile.
Holds full of old corpses that you know from God knows where and God knows when. Act like cordwood waiting to become animated.
There's an old term from World War I and trench warfare that I think is very applicable here, and that is body liquor.
Man. Like, I love that there are some living in Crix so that they could actually experience the horrors and smells and sights of this. Because, like, it in the military, there's always like the new person who you troll a little bit and you make them go do something like collect exhaust fumes or like look for weaknesses in armor tiles that aren't there. And I feel like the Lich Lords would be like, hey, go down to the lower decks and get me an arm. And they go down there and they're like, oh God, this is so horrible. Just piecing through bodies looking for the right arm, come back up. Nope, actually, I needed a leg. Can you go back and get me a
Sure.
leg?
No, I see that more as like something a captain would do to troll somebody, but also when they bring the arm back, like, oh, I needed a left arm, right?
Yes.
And just
Oh.
the putrid squelching of like all of the, let's call them offcuts in the Necrofactorium. Like, you know that they're getting repurposed in some other way, but just imagine like an automotive plant and a butcher that have just like Philadelphia experimented themselves over each other.
Or can
Amazing.
you imagine that Necrotech pack rat that just can't throw anything away?
Oh God. Yeah.
He's
Yeah.
a hoarder.
Like for whatever reason, I have this really visceral aversion to teeth, like missing teeth. They've been used in like some Cronenberg films as ammunition and recently in the Fallout show as ammunition. And just the idea that there's some hoarder necrotech who's trying to amass enough teeth to fill the magazine of a rapid fire weapon that he just has envisioned for one of his jacks.
Awesome.
Teeth Jack coming soon.
Oh,
Tooth
yes.
Jack. I
So
like how Jason's like, yes, and Matt's like, yuck.
I'm gonna.
Now, this happens pretty often when Jason and I are both wound up on a subject where we'll kind of poke and prod each other to even weirder heights.
That's no lie.
Amazing.
I'm gonna answer your question though about writing this thing, to slightly paraphrase. So writing the Necrofactorium Compendium was an opportunity to organize really the history of Chris's technological development in a way that we never have before. The compendium has a short history in it, and by short, I'm sure some people say long, because I tend to write, but it's really concise from the side of well, it focuses on Crix, but it also concisely traces their theft and adaptation of all these different technologies, arcane technologies from necromancy to mechanica to the construction of full warjacks to colossals, etc. And it was strange to just kind of pull those elements out of the story. and to be able to thread them together more or less cohesively. Crix is savage. They take their industrial espionage quite seriously.
Something that I really like about them too is that, like we were saying earlier, nothing goes to waste. There's no
No.
such thing as a failure for Crix. There's just an opportunity to learn something new, right? And suffering losses doesn't matter. Victory on the short timeline doesn't matter. They're just these vultures that are amassing materials and knowledge and arcane technologies over and over and over again.
Awesome. And even if they lose entire armies, the knowledge is still gained, right? Like that's something that you just can't kill in an undead army.
And generally speaking, if they lose a whole army, they did it doing something that makes them a whole new army. Crix doesn't just lose an army without making some corpses. And
And
that's
something else, they don't even have to be the ones making them, right? Like they profiteer off of every conflict that happens in the Iron Kingdoms because little packs of scavengers will go out in the aftermath of a battle and try and collect up any pieces that have been left behind. The fighting of those battles saturates the world with necrotite that they use to fuel their machines. Like the inability for the Iron Kingdoms as a whole to achieve peace is really playing into the hands of Torek and his minions.
And nothing, gins up the technologies around killing folk quite like war.
I can just see like a little contingent of Helldivers that just like pop up underneath the battlefield and like drag bodies away. They come back to get their bodies and they're like, where did everybody go? Did the battle happen yet? Did we miss it?
There's a fair amount about them scavenging the battlefields of Imran and its implications.
Amazing. So, is there anything else Crix fiction related you want to talk about before we end this segment?
I'm looking forward to writing the heroes and villains entries for their new casters.
I'm personally looking forward to seeing what their cadres look like.
Yes.
We've been having some discussions about those, going back and forth on what would be just like the perfect match to go with this initial Necrofactorium release.
Well, on that note, to be continued, that's fantastic. I love where we're going and all of the sinister workings and inner workings that are coming out of this. Do you have any parting shots, any final words you want to say to the audience?
Being living in Crick sucks because you get glow long.
Check out the Necrofactorium Compendium coming soon.
Awesome. Well, thank you both for being on. It has been an absolute pleasure to talk Crix and to hang out and really dig into the fiction. I look forward to more of these. I know that when we brought Mike on to kind of do the fiction recap, we got a lot of positive review around it from listeners who wanted more fiction talk. And so they're getting exactly that from this segment. And I can't wait till our next one.
Awesome. Thank you for having us
Splendid.
on, man.
Definitely. You want to say roll drums?
Go for it, Jason.
I was waiting for you.
All right. 3, 2, 1, roll
Roll
drums.
drums. Hello, everyone, and welcome back. Joining me in this segment is none other than the Bokur himself, Seth Cohen. How you doing?
I prefer the term Boker Boss,
Oh, my apologies, Bokur boss.
sir.
Fancy.
I'm doing good. I'm just tired and sore and worn out and achy. And although I avoided con crud this year, so I'm ahead of the game.
Nice. Well, and it sounds like we're alluding a little bit to what we're here to talk about today, which is a recap of the Bokur Brawl that just passed. Seth is the Bokur boss behind this, and I wanted to bring him on to talk a little bit about what it took to get ready for it, how it went, and what some of his takeaways are. Seth, do you want to start out by telling everybody a little bit about who you are?
Sure. So I've been a now a long, long time organizer and judge and player and war machine. I've been there since Mark One. Awesome. It's worth saying that the Boca Brawl isn't just mine. It also belongs to Steve Rabideau, although I am more of the public face, so people tend to associate it with me. But it doesn't happen with Steve. So shout out to Steve for keeping us on the rails.
Amazing. And I assume something of this level with this much planning had a lot to get you ready for it.
So this year specifically was a lot harder than previous to get things ready. We made a commitment to 3D model friendly terrain. We put on sort of like a trial run at Captain Con with our friend David Lee, who's running the events at Captain Con. And my 3D printer and Steve's 3D printer and David's 3D printer have been grinding away since like early November. And then, everything had to get printed. It had to get painted. And it was to the point where there just wasn't an evening where I was like, oh, I have an evening free. I could always be painting terrain. I could always be building terrain. So that was a huge effort on everybody's part. I had some folks who, you know, when I really got down to the grind, who were helping me out. A friend of mine, Dan Schwenke, one of the greats, he printed out a bunch of things for us. Another friend, Henry, he did a lot of airbrushing of some effects on some terrain for us. So it was just more than the usual this year, but it's always so busy. And I would say if it's not painting terrain, the other thing that keeps us busy is placing people on teams, right? Because the Boca Brawl does a lot of stuff over a course of 3 days, but we call it our marquee event. We do a 5-person team event Saturday to Sunday. And there are always people who want to play in a 5-person team event. And we created it specifically for those people who weren't necessarily going to go to a WTC, right? Mm-hmm. We wanted to create that experience for everybody. So folks contact me months ahead of time, weeks ahead of time, and this year a day ahead of time, looking for a team. We got everybody placed this year, and it was pretty fantastic. It was a lot of work this year to get us going, but it had to be our best yet. It was a fantastic event.
Amazing. And 3D model friendly terrain has got to be almost an oxymoron. That is very difficult to achieve. What did you do to make it both friendly for models and players, but also look good?
So to make it model friendly, a model has to be able to stand on it, right? Mm-hmm. So certainly Gonzo gets some credit here because he was working on this with me, pointing me to STLs that I could use. A lot of times it's simply lowering the Z, you know, the height of any model or any design that we found that we were able to use. The rule of thumb is somewhere between 3 and 4 millimeters. If it's higher than that, models have a tough time standing on it. The painting, well, that's just you know, good old-fashioned painting. It's a lot of dry brushing, right? It's a lot of very heavy dry brushing and getting all the help you can get because you can't do it yourself.
That is the trick. Well, I couldn't agree more. It is both important that models can move around and stand on and interact with terrain because that's one of the things that makes the game so tactical. But it's also really important for it to look good because when you go to a convention, you want to fully immerse yourself into the game. When you go to a tournament like this, you want to be able to become part of the game yourself. And so kudos to you for that effort, that Herculean effort since November to get that done for the players.
Yeah, I think it's really important. And a lot of folks ask me about where I found the files and could they buy some terrain. I ended up giving a lot of terrain away. Because people need it for their clubs, right? And what's going to expand the hobby and what's going to attract people over to the table, but good looking terrain. And then if you're playing on it as well, that's just an added bonus. I think the 2D terrain has had its time, but the game has moved forward. And the community has moved forward, and I think it's going to be 3D from here on out.
And what a great tease. Go to Boca Brawl, walk away with some terrain.
Well, don't say that. No.
He's like, don't volunteer my terrain.
No. I mean, it's...
You said it. I'm not saying anything you didn't say.
We actually pride ourselves in giving away a ton of prize support. When we created the Boca Brawl, we wanted high-quality tournaments where every player, whether they were in the top place or the bottom place, felt like they were valued for being there. And one of the things we do on Friday is all our events qualify someone for the Boca Bounty Table. And that's just a table full of prizes. And you have a bounty sheet on the that you get given. And anything you do during a game or many things you do during a game, be more accurate, can qualify you for a level of prizing. So if you lose a game, that's a tier 4 prize, right? If you lose 3 games, that's a tier 1 prize. And you know, of course, you have to hope there's something left in tier 1 by the end of the day. You're taking a gamble. But, you know, things like throwing the same model twice in one game, or, you know, playing with a painted list or two painted lists. Steve Rabideau really knocked it out of the park this year with the Boker Bounty list. And it's just one of the great things that we do. And people over the years have donated prizes. They show up to the brawl, they're like, oh, hey, here are these boxes that I'm just never going to use. Let's put them on the prize table. Someone showed up with their entire mini crate collection, and we were giving stuff away all weekend long. And
amazing.
It's one of the things that we really try to do. We want folks to walk away with a ton of stuff. And invariably someone wins, well, I've got this 80 millimeter from this army that I don't play. Maybe I'm going to start to play it now. So we take credit for expanding people's armies collections.
I love that. Both the thematic the thematic angle of having a bounty table and players getting to be mercenaries themselves, but also, you know, a community-driven event that is also supported through charity is just incredible, because that is what brings people together.
The community is fantastic.
Yes, they are.
You know, Steve and I, and this year David Lee, you know, we just run the event. We don't have a staff, right? Mm. Steve Rabideau is a WTC captain, so he needed to play in the team event. So David Lee stepped up for us all weekend long. Awesome. But, you know, we don't have a staff. So we're player-centered. So we have water jugs around the hall so people can fill up their water bottles or just get a cup of water. And those have to be filled several times throughout a day. And people see me lugging a water jug. They say, no, I got it. And, you know, awesome. They'll grab it from me and fill that water jug up in the VFW kitchen. Or if I need to adjust some tables or move some things, I've got more hands than I know what to do with. This year, you know, setup is Thursday night, and traditionally some people show up, and after we set up, we'll sit around, we'll have a drink at the VFW bar there. There were so many people, I think setup was done in 2 hours. Like, I came back from bringing the rental truck back, and it was like done. So just tremendous community support. I have to shout out Tried and True. All those guys, they really step up to help make everything as successful as possible. Really outstanding. The Buffalo guy showed up again, like they do every year, and helped set up. I know I'm leaving people out, which is always a danger of naming people, but it was really fantastic.
Well, and I appreciate the shout outs, because we want to be able to plug the community and show our support anywhere we can because of how amazing their support is for events like this.
Absolutely.
Go ahead.
I was going to say, I didn't get a chance to tell you about our Friday events, because we're very proud of those as well.
Yeah, go ahead.
Well, we run the IG qualifier, of course, which, you know, always fills up. And then we run something called the Big Base Brawl, the BBB. And if you want to get technical, it's the BBBBB. We like alliteration. We like alliteration here.
Yes.
And what we do is we run two pods, 16 in each pod, and the top 8 from each pod then get ranked using tie breaks. And they get to pick from 16 huge base models.
Wow.
And they get to walk away with a huge base model. The first place person picks first, and then on down the line. So every year we have to come up with 16 huge base models. And that event sold out super quick this year. And someone reached out and they said, well, why can't you just have another one? Because I can't buy another 16 huge base models. That's why we can't have another one.
Yeah. Like, that's like $2,000, $3,000.
Yeah, it's a big investment. So
that
event's fantastic. This year we did two new things. We did a narrative event. We called it A Bridge Too Far. We printed a big, huge bridge. We set up a town and people fought over the bridge. And then that was a lot of fun. I had my friend Fen run that, you know, dungeon master that event. And we had a great time with that. And then we had a special table we put together called the Kane Run. And the theme of this table was Kane was super drunk and had to get out of town before the townspeople knocked him out and arrested him. So one person plays Kane, one person plays the townspeople. We had all sorts of funky rules. It was definitely a beta test of that table. A couple people played and gave us some suggestions, but we think that one's gonna stick around, put a lot of work into making that thing look really great. That was a lot of fun. And
that's hilarious.
Yeah, it was just a great time. It was a great time.
Well, it sounds like you had some amazing events that I've never even heard of. I mean, talk about a narrative event that takes you right into the Iron Kingdoms up close and personal. So I love the concept there. So other than hang out and organize for people, did you get any games in yourself?
No, not yet.
Oh.
Oh gosh, I am dying to play. I had a goal with Mark IV that I was going to play a lot more. I have failed miserably at this goal. I have a fantastic Orgoth army that I just don't get to hang out
Yes.
with, but I got myself a Garlgast over that weekend,
Nice.
and I think that's going to inspire me to try to put together some Garlgast lists that my very accomplished friends can then tell me why it won't work.
That's amazing. I have some wild Orgoth lists myself. It's a good time with the Cadre box just coming out, the Garlgast just coming out. There are so many things to explore right now in Orgoth. It's a good time to be a
It
raider.
absolutely is. There's a lot of great armies coming out. I think that there's still a lot of play with a lot of legacy armies. I saw a
Oh
lot of
yeah.
stuff over the weekend. So yeah, there's a lot of life left in a lot of armies.
Without a doubt. So, what were some of your favorite moments throughout the weekend? Did you have any just amazing highlights or moments where everybody cheered and you were just like, this is what it's all about?
So the highlight for me, so this year we didn't give out medals. We created the Bokey. We printed a Boker, and the Boker was standing very much like the Oscar, right? And
Nice.
when I took out the Bokeys and handed them to people, the roar of that crowd, that 100 people, and of course, by the time you get to the awards Sunday afternoon, that 100 people has been whittled down to about, maybe 60, because people have to get home, right? People have to catch planes, people have to do all sorts of stuff. The roar from those folks when those awards went out was so gratifying, was so gratifying. That's that moment where you say to yourself, okay, I nailed it. Right, everyone had this fantastic time cheering for the people that beat them in previous rounds, and that was just fantastic. Other highlights for me, well, I'd have to say David Lee, he's still new to judging, right? He's cutting his teeth. He did a fantastic job all weekend, and there was one point where I was like, he said, "Oh, I had this rules call. I don't even remember what it is." And I said, I think we may have gotten that one wrong." And no, he got it right. I was wrong. That was a fantastic moment. Not that
Nice.
I'm always going to get everything right, but that was a nice little moment. No, he understood those rules a whole heck of a lot better than I did at that moment. He did a great job. The people playing the cane run and people playing the narrative run, I mean, those were our big risks, right? So people playing those and having fun really meant a lot to me. That was great. Yeah, it was one fantastic weekend all weekend long.
Amazing. It sounds like it. I am so sad to have missed it myself all the way out here on the West Coast, but maybe we'll have to get a Boker Brawl West Coast going on one of these days.
Well, I'll tell you, I throw out the offer every year that we would love to see a Privateer Press five-person team come on out and play at the Brawl. Every year we offer, every year we don't have a Privateer Press team. Just saying, maybe next year's the year you field the team.
Well, it sounds like the gauntlet has been thrown. Now, I don't get to make those decisions, but I would absolutely love to play. So, what were some of your takeaways? Do you think you would do anything different next year? Do you have anything that was like, I wish I had thought of this ahead of time? Or maybe it was just that aha moment while you're in the groove.
Well, a lot of things actually. So one of the things was the narrative event. Well, our plan was to do a piece of this narrative each day. But what the players explained to us was, hey, you made us choose between do we play in the big event or do we take time out and play the narrative? And even though we ran the narrative at night, we were so tired after the day, we didn't want to play it. So I think next year the narrative is going to be like its own tournament, three rounds in a day,
Oh,
right? And
snap.
We also ran the campaign in a day. We put one of the Black Tide campaigns and we played it out. And I think what I'm going to have to do, for the Black Tide campaigns, some of those scenarios are very, very involved. And I think I need to spend a little more time just simplifying them a little bit because too much of the player's time was spent trying to figure out what the scenario was supposed to do. And then we created our own terrain piece this year. Arthur Continelli created the ridge. It was a wall and a hill together as one terrain piece. Mm-hmm. Mike Garabini helped me with the rules for that. We put out the rules and we got really good feedback on that. And basically the consensus was, it was a great thought. It was a great effort, but on the tabletop, it didn't work out very well. But people felt that they would like to see that at like a local or, you know, for game night, but not part of a 3-round tournament. So I'm going to take the ridges that I printed and retire many of them and put a few into the, you know, the store holdings for local stuff. We're going to try to come up with something different for next year because we always got to build. Mm-hmm. And then my other goal for next year is I want to create themed tables. So something like, you know, a destroyed Menoth shrine and whatever terrain would go around that. And one out of every five tables be this Menoth shrine with appropriate scatter terrain and appropriate obstructions and appropriate walls and all those kinds of things. And then if it works out, each year add another, and within 5 years I'll have nothing but themed tables.
Nice. I made a few pieces of themed huge base terrain myself. I had some colossals that I had used for various projects, or I had salvaged from armies that I had received as people move and change hands, and I wasn't sure what to do with them. And then I thought, you know, these would probably make amazing terrain pieces, especially ones that are like missing legs or missing an arm or something. And so I had a downed hurricane that had an arc node. So when you got close enough to it, you could use it to arc spells through.
Excellent.
We had a downed kraken that you could walk up to and use its big unicorn cannon. So there are so many different ways that you can make interactive terrain out of stuff you find all the time or old models. And I'm just so hyped up to see those kind of interactive tables emerging into the greater game.
Absolutely.
So we've talked about what it took to get ready. We've talked about the events and what you had to do. Do you have any parting shots? Anything you want to talk about, where your passion's at, or maybe some last minute thoughts here?
Well, I haven't mentioned probably the greatest organizer coup ever in the history of ever. Privateer allowed me to hire Doug Hamilton to create a 30-millimeter custom objective for everybody who attended the brawl. And of course, because the NJSOBs helped put on the Boker Brawl, mm-hmm. He made it a New Jersey themed objective, and he created Boker Bon Jovi. And if you haven't seen the pictures, you absolutely should. It is a totally 100% limited edition thing, because once I'm done giving away the ones that I printed, we're never printing anymore. And I don't know how I'm going to top that. So I'm kind of throwing it out there to the universe. If someone's got a good way for me to top that, I'd love to hear it. Because we got to keep building. We got to keep moving forward. Rising tide raises all ships, sir. And we need to raise this ship.
Absolutely. So where can people go to find out more about the Boker Brawl or how to get involved with it?
So we have a website that no one actually ever uses, and I would love that people went there. It is www.thebokerbrawl.com. We just got our new date. It is actually May 2nd, 3rd, and 4th of next year. I updated the date on the website and the counter and the countdown. We always start ticket sales on February 15th. I haven't updated anything else yet. I'm very findable on Facebook, and we do a lot of posting there on our Boker Brawl Facebook page. Mm-hmm. And I think that's all I got.
Well, it has been absolutely a pleasure to have you on to talk about the Boker Brawl, to talk about the zany fun things you got to do. And if you're out there and this sounds like something that's fun for you, start planning now. You know, a year is a great time to get your logistics, to find a hotel, to save up for plane tickets, to hitchhike a ride with your best friends, whatever it happens to be. And next year, I have no doubt you're going to make it even better.
Outstanding. I appreciate the time, sir.
Definitely. Well, as an honor to any of our guests or co-hosts that come on the show, I like to give you the option to say roll drums. Would you like to take us out?
Roll drums.